This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up, you'll hear from filmmaker Sky Bergman about her latest film, about a tradition that brings generations of family together.
Mochisuki is a ceremony really about hope and about bringing in the new year and hope for a better new year.
Also, we'll visit with the authors of the book, Your Brain on Art.
We've been so focused on optimizing for efficiency and productivity that the arts, if it wasn't going to be your profession, was pushed aside when actually it's imperative for our health and well-being.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, May 13th, 2024. I'm Carol Tangeman. In recent years, the Central Coast has experienced intense summer heat waves, and there are more projected for the future. In a four-part series called The Heat Beat, Beth Thornton reports about how communities can prepare for heat events and save lives. The first step is awareness.
Extreme heat is considered one of the deadliest climate-related hazards. When temperatures soar and stay high for multiple days, it takes a toll on people's health. And even though the Central Coast is known for its moderate climate, projections for the region show an increase in frequency and severity of heat waves in the coming decades. Kristen Gerges is a project scientist with Scripps Institute in San Diego.
So the projections for the Central Coast suggest that there could be about five times as many days of extreme heat by the end of the century.
Gerges says extreme heat is measured by changes in average daily temperatures, and that number varies by location.
So if you live someplace that's near the coast where you have a really mild, you know, conditions and it generally doesn't get very hot, then your extreme is going to be not the same as somebody living, you know, in the inland kind of deserts part of California.
On the Central Coast, there are vastly different temperatures depending on proximity to the ocean. For example, Paso Robles and Cuyama are regularly hotter than, say, Pismo Beach in Santa Barbara. Gerges says wherever you live, if temperatures are higher than usual for extended periods of time, there's more risk for health complications, like dehydration, heat exhaustion, and heat stroke. Gerges points to 2006 as a wake-up call for scientists in California. That's when a devastating heat wave hit the West Coast.
Yeah, there were hundreds of deaths attributed to that heat wave.
She says after that event, it became more urgent to study and understand the health impacts of heat. But it's only now, many heat waves later, that the state is taking steps to prepare. In 2022, the governor's office published a report called Protecting Californians from Extreme Heat. It's an action plan for building more resilient communities. The report identifies outdoor workers, the elderly, young children, low-income residents, and those who are pregnant or have chronic illness as most vulnerable to extreme heat. It cites isolation and lack of air conditioning as significant risk factors. With the state's call for action, counties across California are now assessing their climate vulnerabilities. Elizabeth Merson is with the County of San Luis Obispo Public Health Department.
Extreme heat is one of the top hazards that has been identified in the preliminary findings.
She says the county aims to take advantage of grant money available from the state to increase resilience, and they are exploring ways to do that.
We just started meeting with our colleagues specifically in Santa Barbara, Ventura, and Monterey to discuss climate. So looking at it on a Central Coast region level and seeing what sort of regional approach we can have.
Merson says SLO County will release more information about their plans in June. Given that the Central Coast has experienced summer heat waves several years in a row, it's important for counties to have plans in place, especially for vulnerable populations. Here's Kristen Gerges, the climate scientist.
I think it's very important to start preparing now, to think about what we can do today to make these risks less in the future, because these kind of preparations, they can save lives.
Our series, The Heat Beat, will include conversations with health professionals, local officials, and nonprofit organizations as heat-related projects get underway on the Central Coast. For KCBX, I'm Beth Thornton.
Later this week on Morning Edition and All Things Considered, you'll hear the second part of our series. The Heat Beat will include conversations with health professionals, local officials, and nonprofit organizations as heat-related projects get underway on the Central Coast. This project is made possible by a grant from the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism. You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. Up next, you'll hear from Sky Bergman. An accomplished, award-winning photographer, Bergman was the former chair of the Art and Design Department at Cal Poly, where she's been teaching since 1995. Lives Well Lived was her debut film. It's currently airing on PBS. The film celebrates the incredible wit and wisdom of adults 75 to 100 years old who are living their lives to the fullest. 40 people share their secrets and insights to living a meaningful life. And Sky's latest film, Mochizuki, explores the ancient tradition of preparing mochi to celebrate the Japanese New Year. It will be airing on PBS as part of Asian American Month, May 2025. But there's a 20-minute sneak preview coming up this month at the Palm Theater. Welcome, Sky.
Thank you very much for having me.
I feel like I saw the word emeritus after your name recently.
Yes, well, that's kind of a misnomer. I did retire, but I am still teaching part-time, so I am still out there, and I'll do that for another couple of years. I love it. I love the cycle of giving and receiving and to just be around the students. It's really wonderful. But I am semi-retired in that I usually take fall quarter off at this point and can work on these projects, on these film projects and a book project, and I just have a little more time to do the things that I have been wanting to do for a while.
Yeah. It's nice when you can do your own creative things and then also, like you say, give back and stay tied to the university.
That's the best possible situation. Absolutely.
Yeah. Lives Well Lived. It was a big success. And most recently, it's been on PBS. And now I see you have with you a book.
Yeah. So the film is still on PBS, which is amazing. And now it's starting to get international acclaim, which is wonderful. Wonderful. Yeah. I thank my grandmother every day because she was the reason that I did the film. I was looking at approaching 50 and looking for positive role models of aging and had one in my own family who was my grandmother. And she set me on a quest to interview those 40 people. And what an amazing journey because it was my first film. It did super well. So now it got me into a whole third act of filmmaking. And, you know, along the way, one of the things that I really wanted to do with the film was to connect generations. So we do all these intergenerational projects where we show the film and to older adults and to students, and we connect them. They use the questions that I used in the film to connect and learn about each other, and then they do a big wrap party at the end of the quarter. And we've been doing that pretty successfully at Cal Poly for the last 8 years. And through that, I started learning about other really wonderful projects that were connecting generations. And so I set on another quest to write a book, partly about the lessons that I learned along the way of making the Lives Well Lived film from all the 40 people that I interviewed. And that's the first half of the book. And the second half of the book is these amazing people around the globe that I interviewed who are doing very interesting work connecting generations, from intergenerational symphonies to co-generational housing to theater productions, and just so many interesting ways that we can change the narrative around our age-segregated society and really bring generations together. I think that's how we're going to heal, is by bringing generations together.
Yeah, we are. I hadn't thought of it that way. Age segregated. It seems like in the more recent past that, well, when you retire, you move to a community where you're just surrounded by, you know, other retired people. And
it kind of
goes against the traditional idea of family, really.
Right. And I was lucky enough that I grew up in a four-generational household. My great-grandmother was actually still alive.
Wow.
She lived to be in her 90s. I was 19 when she passed away. So I had this experience that a lot of people don't have of having multiple generations in my life. And I really have made that a mission that every project that I do will have this intergenerational connection in some way, whether it's a film or a book or whatever I work on will have that as an element of what I do.
So your latest project is absolutely intergenerational, and it's really fun. I've only seen the trailer, but it is so fun to watch. So let's talk about Mochizuki.
Yeah, well, I was introduced to Mochizuki through one of the film stars from the Lives We'll Live project, which was Susie Edo Bauman, who is Japanese-American. And when I interviewed her, one of the things she talked about was this Mochizuki ceremony where generations get together to make mochi to bring in the new year. And the way that you make mochi is you have a big usu or bowl, you steam rice, you put that rice into this bowl, and then you have these mallets that they basically pound the rice until it's very, very smooth. So you can't even see that there's rice there. And then they take that and form mochi balls, basically. And a lot of times they will use that in their ozoni, which is a soup that they eat for the New Year's. And it's just such a wonderful tradition of bringing generations together. I think I was drawn to it because of my relationship with my grandmother and being in the kitchen with her. Of course, she was Italian, so food's very important in an Italian household. And when I grew up in her kitchen. And really, the traditions, the wisdom, the love, that was all passed down in the kitchen as I stood next to her while we were cooking together. And so to see that in another culture, another tradition, I really gravitated towards that. And So Susie invited me to go to a Mochizuki, and I was just hooked. I fell in love with the beauty of it, the idea of it. The resilience of Mochizuki is something that Japanese Americans have done for many years. I mean, the tradition itself goes back to the 8th century.
Oh, and so the tradition came from Japan.
Yes.
And now the tradition traveled with the Japanese here.
Yes.
And so people do it in Japan as well?
They do. They do. In fact, I have two Japanese American nephews who my brother married a Japanese woman, and they live in Japan. And the day that I was filming, one of the days that I was filming Mochizuki here in Los Osos, they were doing a Mochizuki in Japan. So that was pretty wonderful. Nice connection to my family back there.
Yeah, a lot of different cultures seem to have a tradition, you know, of this sort. I think of Mexican families and tamales. Is that
yes.
a general tradition or just certain families that make tamales around the holidays together?
No, I think that's a general tradition that is something. And one of the ideas that I had, if I had an unlimited amount of funds and an unlimited amount of time, I would love to do a whole series of food and traditions. Mm. And if you really think back to your childhood, there was probably some moment where food connected generations, maybe on a yearly basis. Maybe it was a tamale making or different things, like we made pasta together, and we would have on Christmas the seven seafood. You know, for anybody that's Italian, you understand the seven fishes. And there's some tradition that probably was carried on, and I love that idea. And so I would love to do a series all around food traditions.
The different traditions we did, and this is probably just a typical American thing, but on Thanksgiving morning, putting the stuffing together.
Mm-hmm.
We'd throw together all the breadcrumbs, and the whole thing for us then was adding things and tasting it. And my mom and my grandma would be like, so is that enough? Is that an, I don't know. But that was our tradition. And then I know someone who's Swedish, they made sausage together.
Mm-hmm.
And they would do it, you know, the nieces and nephews, everyone would come over, and that was their thing. They made sausage.
Yeah, and it's wonderful to see whatever ways we can do to connect generations and come together. I think, you know, where there's an epidemic right now of loneliness, and I think that in part that's due to all the generations. We move away from each other. We're not connected in the same way that we used to be. And so at these moments where we can connect and come back together, and I think it's for a common goal. It's a common, you know, something that we're all going to eat together, share together. I think there's something really beautiful about that. And it reminds us that we're not alone. So it reminds us that we have a community, that we have a family, that we have a group that we belong to. And I think that's really vitally important.
And I think a lot of us figured that out during the pandemic. In the worst way.
Absolutely.
So when I was watching the trailer for the film, it's just, it's beautifully filmed. And there are times when they're hitting the mochi with the mallet in the big bowl. It's rhythmic. The way it was filmed, it's just beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Well, there's definitely a beauty to the actual ceremony itself. I mean, it's just, it's usually done at a farm because that's the place that a lot of people could gather. And, you know, you're in a shed where there's beautiful light coming in and the steam from the rice cooking. Yeah. And then, like you said, the sound of the mallets hitting the rice and the usu. You just, it's just a wonderful, wonderful moment. And then you have kind of the hum of people talking. You know what that sounds like? We're just that sound of voices all intermixed with those wonderful sounds, smells, sights. It's just, it's beautiful.
Yeah, and with different people, like you said, of different generations, some kids running around and a little kid hugging a grandpa and, you know, just all the different things that just say family and, you know, connection. I want to take a minute to listen to the trailer. Let's play the trailer for Mochisuki.
Mochi is a rice that after you steam it, you pound it till it gets smooth.
They cut them up into all small biscuit-sized pieces of mochi. Either have it plain, in the traditional ways you put on, which is sweet red beans. And then we learned that it's also good with peanut butter.
I love it. I love it. When they say you're supposed to eat as many as your age, I get close to it.
I think it was the 8th century that it started in Japan.
From what my dad used to tell us, they decorate the mantle with this mochi for good luck for the year.
And they would put salt and a little mochi stack on all of the farm equipment for the gods, for the machinery to stay healthy.
In the 1920s or 30s, Los Angeles was one of the largest produce counties in all of the United States. If you ate vegetable or a piece of fruit around that time, chances are it was produced by a Japanese American. In spring of 1942, posters start going up in public places to the attention of all persons of Japanese ancestry, and this is when the forced removal starts to happen. 125,000 plus individuals were impacted during World War II.
I was only 1 year old when we were relocated, but my mother told me about all these different camps still celebrated the Mochisuki.
They made a usu, the container that you pound the mochi in. They found scrap wood and they made mallets and they made mochi. Even during World War II, during one of the most difficult times that the community experienced.
After the war, while their lives just seemed so uncertain, Mochizuki was this reminder that, you know, maybe they could have good luck for the rest of the year.
We've been doing it every year since 1982. We get 2,500 people coming out, 7 usus going at one time.
I've been pretty much coming here my whole life, and my grandpa runs the show. He's 82. He's really friendly. He likes to tell people what to do.
Mochisuki is connection of the spiritual aspect of a new year and the interdependency of land and human life.
It's nice to know that things are going to go on even when you're gone.
If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Carol Tangeman, and with me today is Sky Bergman, award-winning photographer, filmmaker. We're talking about her latest film, Mochizuki.
The film is not just about Mochizuki, but about the Japanese-American experience. And Lily Tamai talks about why Japanese-Americans came to this country and why they brought their foodways with them to, you know, it's like that comfort of home. And I think that Mochizuki and making mochi was part of that. And that became really important. And that's why that tradition survives. And one of the things that has been really interesting for me is finding other Mochizuki ceremonies. There's one that I filmed just this past year in Irvine and at the Tanaka Farms. 2,500 people showed up
Wow.
for that. And it was amazing to see seven usus going at one time and really just how many people gathered for something like that. I think that's a testament to how important that ceremony is.
Mm-hmm. Was it difficult to film? Did you just say, okay, we're showing up to watch?
Pretty much. The Edo family was very wonderful and let me film. And so I filmed three different Mochizuki ceremonies. And one of them, I started interviewing people about the importance of it to them, different age groups. So from teenagers to people in their 80s. And I think that that was really important to hear the difference in terms of what it meant to them. And I had since have also incorporated the Japanese-American experience as told through this, the through line of Mochizuki. I think that's really important because food can be a way to get us through some very tough times. And so there's this sense of resilience. You know, Mochizuki is a ceremony really about hope and about bringing in the new year and hope for maybe a better new year. And even when Japanese Americans were incarcerated during World War II, they still figured out a way to have the Mochizuki ceremony. And one of the most wonderful serendipitous moments of working on this film was that as a photographer, of course, this was a really amazing. I stumbled upon, through a friend of mine, Paul Morey, the photographs of Toyo Miyataki, who was a very famous photographer in his day at the level of Ansel Adams, and he was friends with Edward Weston. And I knew of his work, but I didn't know that he had photographed a Mochizuki in Manzanar. And when I saw that photograph, I reached out to his grandsons, who still owns the studio. And I said, can I interview you? And he said, oh, yeah. So I came down to his studio, which is down near LA. It used to be in Little Tokyo. And his grandfather, Toyo Miyataki, when he knew he was going to be incarcerated in Manzanar, he actually smuggled a lens and a film back into the camp and built a camera so that he could photograph what was happening. And one of the things that he photographed was a Mochizuki ceremony. And to hear that story, and his grandson still has a camera that he built, and to hear that story of resilience and to hear that, you know, he wanted to show what was happening so that we wouldn't repeat those same mistakes. And he knew that there were photographers photographing, like Dorothea Lange and Ansel Adams, but they were photographing from the outside in, and he was photographing as somebody that was inside.
Yeah, he
and
knew
very different.
He had a different sense of what was important.
Absolutely.
To document.
Mm-hmm.
If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Carol Tangeman, and with me today is Sky Bergman, award-winning photographer, filmmaker. We're talking about her latest film, Mochizuki. My daughter tried to make mochi once at home. Do you know?
I'm sorry. Mochi, you know, I think one of the things that's really beautiful about some of these food traditions is that they require a lot of people to come together to make something as a group. And it's, well, now they do have mochi making machines. So, you know, you can, but you still, I know people that have that. And basically what it does, it kind of replaces the pounding of the rice, but you still have to come together to make the mochi balls. And you still have a very limited amount of time, otherwise it gets hard. So it's still a communal event that happens.
Okay.
But what did your daughter think when she made it?
Oh, it was kind of a disaster. She pounded and pounded and pounded on the kitchen table and ended up with kind of a lumpy lump. And then I feel like she tried to add some water. I don't know. she'll appreciate watching the film.
Oh, yeah. Well, also, I think one of the things that people don't realize is there is a very particular kind of rice that people use to make mochi.
So, oh.
It's made by Coda Farms, and they are up in the Los Baños area. And everybody knows that's the rice that you use to make mochi. So if you try and use a different kind of rice, because it's more of like a stickier rice, and you have to have a very particular kind of rice. Otherwise, it doesn't really form.
Yeah.
No.
Right.
And I think it's also kind of funny because people think of mochi. They think of like the mochi ice cream, mochi itself. It's a very different kind of thing. It's very chewy, and I think it's an acquired taste.
Do you eat it with other foods, I assume?
They'll eat it on its own. They will put it in that ozoni soup for the new year.
So with the film now, what comes next?
That's always a good question. What comes next?
Yeah.
We're doing a sneak preview at the Palm Theater on May 19th at 11 o'clock in the morning. You know, it's always nice to feel an audience. So we're just showing 20 minutes of the film. It's going to be on PBS May of 2025 for Asian American Pacific Islander Month. And so we're kind of gearing up for that and getting everything done. It takes a while to make a film, especially when it's a small, I say we're a small and mighty crew and a scrappy, a little bit of a scrappy crew kind of putting things together. But it's really important to take my time. And I feel like I'm, you know, people have entrusted me with their stories. And so that's something that I don't take lightly. And I'm looking forward to having it on PBS next May.
Next May.
2025.
PBS, and that will be the entire film. What is it?
It's like about an hour long. So PBS, their hour long programming is 56 minutes and 46 seconds. So that, to be precise, that's what it will be.
It sounds like you know that.
Yes, all too well.
So this is it's a sneak preview, and it's at the Palm.
Mm-hmm.
Is there another way for people to see the film if they can't make it to the Palm, the 20-minute sneak preview?
Absolutely. We're doing a virtual screening from May 15th to June 15th. And if people go to the website, which is just mochi-film.com, and mochi, if you don't know how to spell this, mochi-film.com, you can find a link to look at that sneak preview. And we're going to have a virtual Q&A as well with some of the film stars on June 1st. So all that information is there.
Well, thank you, Skye. From what I saw of it, it's just, it's a beautiful film.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Skye Bergman, award-winning photographer, filmmaker, her latest film, Mochi Suki. This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Carol Tangeman. UCSB Reads is a campus-wide reading event, and on May 9th, the authors of Your Brain on Art led a discussion about their book at Campbell Hall. Student reporter Brandon Yee spoke with authors Susan McSammon and Ivy Ross.
Authors Ivy Ross and Susan McSammon showed a healing nature of art through their book Your Brain on Art. I asked the authors about their collaboration and the significance of art in our modern society.
I'm Susan McSammon.
And I'm Ivy Ross.
For the first question, Susan, can you talk about how you came to connect with neuroscience and the arts during or after your time at Johns Hopkins?
Sure. So I think I was really born into the arts and aesthetic experiences. I always loved nature as a kid. I come from a family of makers, meaning knitters and crocheters and needleworkers. And my mom writes poetry. My grandfather was a really great cook and a drummer. And my sisters and I all sort of created all kinds of things and made plays and put on shows. But when I was 12, my twin sister had a farming accident and almost lost her leg. And if you know anything about twins are incredibly telepathic. And at that moment, we weren't able to connect to each other. And we now know that part of her brain called the BRCA area shut down because of the trauma. So she couldn't find words. And she really was sort of cut off. And so my mom suggested that she start to draw, not because my mother knew anything about art therapy, but because my sister was just inconsolable. And she started to draw. And through those drawings, I started to be able to understand what was happening with her through symbol and metaphor. And she started to understand and created a narrative of how she was feeling and how petrified she was and how afraid she was about what would happen for the rest of her life. And so it was in that time that I think I really understood at a very deep level that we communicate and we share ourselves in so many different ways. And so my work has always been about arts and learning, arts and health, arts and well-being. And so coming to Hopkins, I was first working, I developed a couple companies that were arts-based companies, sold them, and then was invited to work at Hopkins in the School of Ed. And at Hopkins, we were really interested in arts and learning. And that's a field that I think has still enormous potential that has been yet to be realized. And but the more we know about the neurophysiology of the arts, the more it's clear that in school settings, the arts have to be there for many reasons. But we had a donor at the School of Medicine who wanted to give Hopkins a lot of money, but they wanted Hopkins to study the arts. The donor believed that the arts could save us. And I knew that she was right. But in a school of medicine, that's not the kind of thing that people are really thinking about. And so they gave me a great honor in asking me to come and try to figure out how to build a program. And so over this started in 2007. So since that time, we've really been building the Arts and Mind Lab, which is now the Center for Applied Neuroaesthetics. And we've developed models on how to study the arts. We do a lot of work in research and translational research, but also in outreach and education. And so in that work, we have something called the Luminary Scholars. Around 2018, I reached out to Ivy and said, we do this thing. I reached out to her on LinkedIn. We do this work in the arts, and we have this program where we lift up people who are doing extraordinary things in the arts in the world, in the real world. And I would love to talk to you about it. And to my delight, this was a cold call, right? This was just like, you know, dialing for dollars. She reached out, she reached back and she said, I'm interested in this. And so maybe I'll turn it over to Ivy.
So I get, you know, like 300 LinkedIn requests and I usually swipe left. But when I saw the Arts and Mind Lab, right, my two favorite things combined, because I started as an artist and then I've been running design teams within companies my whole life. And Susan had said, you know, I've been following your career for 25 years. I want to talk to you about this luminary group. I swiped right and I said yes. And 30-minute conversation turned into 3 hours. She ended up flying to San Francisco. We ended up creating a salon in my living room between, she brought neuroscientists. We both curated. It was like Noah's Ark, two dancers, two singers, two animators, two painters, two of everything category of the arts. And we had this amazing dialogue in my living room around the arts and how it has touched each of us and what's going on in our brains and bodies when we engage in the arts, whether it's as a maker or recipient of the art. And at the end, we're cleaning up and Susan looked at me and said, I've always wanted to write a book about this. Do you want to do this with me? And I said, oh my God, this is the book I've been waiting for. Because as a designer and artist, I've been asked many times in my career, and I was known for innovation and creativity, to write a book, but I'm a lifelong learner, and on innovation and creativity, I do that all the time. So for me, there was no learning in that. So I always said no. But when I said this was the book I've been waiting for, because in this case, it would be both a creative act to do this with Susan together and a learning journey. So that is how we connected and, awesome, and how we did the book.
Hey, you guys are taking the questions right out of my brain.
We do that.
Neuroscientists and artists come together. That's what happens. But I hope you don't mind just like me recalling your event with the sister. When you guys talk about how you guys connected through metaphor and art, it's very interesting that art becomes like, it's almost instinct to seek it as a solution. Like when you talked about how when someone becomes inconsolable, it's instinct for someone to kind of guide them towards art and drawing and to metaphor and through like communicating through that. And it's interesting because outside of like my academics and my host for journalism, it's also I do music and I'm a composer. And I always see myself when I'm explaining something about poetry or prose, or when I'm making an analogy, it always comes back to my connections with music and kind of how I function in that vein and how I'm able to translate that, or at least like make a bridge, not like a direct translation to the topic I'm trying to explain from a musical background.
That's beautiful. And they say, I know, correct me if I'm wrong, Susan, but the poetry and music light up the brain in the same area. So it's super interesting. And I know my parents, unfortunately, used to fight a lot. And I got into the arts because I would close my door and play the drums and do creative acts as a way to kind of just go inward and find another sense of strength.
And grounding, right? I mean, I think more and more we need to ground ourselves and to make sense of the complexity of the world. And I think the arts are an imperative for helping us understand complexity in ourselves and also how we translate that into the world. And, you know, you talked about intuition. You know, we are literally wired for these arts and aesthetic experiences. They're not like a nice to have or something that's a hobby or, you know, in our spare time, which is where how we've relegated them. I had an opportunity to talk to E.O. Wilson, who was a Harvard evolutionary biologist, and he really believed that the reason that humans have evolved the way we have is our capacity to be able to imagine and create and to dance and create those neurochemical bonds with each other, or to create symbol and metaphor and to build those kinds of unique responses to the human condition, as well as be able to absorb and be in the natural world like other animals. If you go from that perspective that we are neurophysiologically wired to create art, it makes sense that there are go-tos when we're trying to grow, when we're trying to flourish, but also when we're trying to heal or understand the complexity of something. You know, we have a lot of things in common, but we're so unique that it's music for you. It's sound for Ivy. I was just telling her that I've been in my garden a lot lately. And, you know, the soil actually, it helps to release serotonin in your body. But we all have a different go-to.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, it's all about creative expression. We have shut down this ability, which we've been given, to creatively express. And it's almost necessary to do that, to get through some of the micro and macro traumas we have in life. But I think, you know, as kids, we do that. And then we're told, you know, that's not the way you draw something, or you'll never make money at that. And so we get shut down. And one of the greatest things, results of the book have been some of the personal letters, hundreds of them we've gotten from people saying, thank you for giving me permission to make art again. And it's like, who knew that we'd have to give strangers permission? But I mean, I get it in that, you know, we've been so focused on optimizing for efficiency and productivity that the arts, if it wasn't going to be your profession, was pushed aside when actually it's imperative for our health and well-being.
If you're just joining us, this is KCBX Public Radio. UCSB student reporter Brandon Yee is speaking with the authors of the book Your Brain on Art, Susan McSammon and Ivy Ross.
And it becomes like a little counterintuitive too when people start approaching art with like productivity.
It's interesting because when you have beginner's mind, curiosity, when you have playful exploration, no, you know, outcome in sight, the return on that effort is exponential, but you're not doing it with a goal in mind. You're doing it to expand your consciousness, right? When you're bringing the world in all these different ways and experiencing it, you have more fodder, you know, more stuff to be able to turn into creative ideas. You know, it's interesting because I've been thinking a lot about the things that are happening on campuses right now with protests. And I think, you know, how do you, you know, find a way to be safe in a space that's so unsafe? And, you know, you talked about you're doing your academics and you have an art form. And I think we all are in these spaces that are highly elevated And also, we still need to be able to take care of ourselves, right? And so how do you move between all of these spaces? And I think these arts practices are really, really helpful. You know, singing together, chanting together, marching together, holding hands together. There's solidarity in that too.
I love when you talk about how art can be grounding.
Marching, dancing, square dancing, like getting in step with someone else, that physical movement actually gets you, your brains connected. So there's something to that.
Yeah. Can you expand on that, Susan?
Sure. I mean, it's really this idea of neuromorphs and synchronicity, and our brains literally, our neurons really firing and wiring together. And it really happens through these experiences that we're describing in terms of marching or singing together. And so, you know, or holding hands, you know, different neurotransmitters are released. So dopamine, serotonin, oxytocin in the case of holding hands and connecting. And this is one of the things that E.O. Wilson talked about, is creating these very strong neurophysiological, neurochemical bonds that connect us to each other. And, you know, we are what's called eusocial in terms of this kind of a species that we are. So ants, termites, bees, these are species that need each other to survive, and they'll actually sacrifice themselves for the group, for the collective, for the legacy of evolution. People are like that too. And it may not always seem that way, but you know, we have to work in harmony. We have to work together. And we know it. We know it at a neurophysiological, genetic level. And so, you know, these are the ways that we do that. You know, also thinking about humming and somatic movement, and these ways that, you know, our bodies naturally move to regulate our nervous systems. We do that individually, but we also do that collectively. So, you know, they talk about stress being contagious, where if I'm stressed, you're going to feel it. But if I'm calm and I'm also pushing out that same neurochemical, you're going to get that too. And so I think we often think of contagion as something negative, but you can spread calm, you can spread ease, you can spread a sense of community by creating these kinds of connections through the sound or music or singing, or the way that, you know, listening to music. I'm doing a talk, kind of a tribute to Marian Anderson, who was the African-American opera singer who was not allowed to be in any venue through the front door. She can only come through the back door. But she sang in a way that brought all races and genders and ages together. And she always sang a song that was sort of a classic opera song. And then she sang a patriotic song that brought everyone together. And you know, I think we don't really always remember how even these patriotic songs bring us together without being on one side of the aisle or the other. They really bring us to what it means to be American, in this case, what it means to love your country, whatever country it is. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we still have those rituals and traditions. And you know, I had the privilege of interviewing a number of indigenous cultures who don't have a word for art because it's how they live their daily lives, right? It's the rituals and the symbols and the movements through everything, the big milestone events, but also the day-to-day rituals that give us meaning and purpose and a sense of community.
Yeah, they sing, they dance, they draw. I mean, that is, they don't call it art, that's life, right? That's how they are together with each other.
Yeah, and it's such an understanding between like individual people and large communities is so important.
You take art out of a community, that's how you depress a community. That's how you gut a community. Is, you know, we say art creates culture, culture creates community, and community creates humanity. So if you want to decimate a community, you take their art away because you take their voice away. We've seen that happen in this country and many countries where you really take the voice, the creative expression away. And so it's a powerful, powerful thing, art. And I think, you know, it can be used for good, and it can also be used for evil.
If you're just joining us, this is KCBX Public Radio. UCSB student reporter Brandon Yee is speaking with the authors of the book Your Brain on Art, Susan McSammon and Ivy Ross.
You know, the purpose of writing the book is, you know, we want to see people adopt art practices, you know, 15, 20 minutes a day, like we've now adopted exercise. Took years of scientific information before people understood that this is what you need to do to stay healthy. So we now know that whether it's doodling or drawing or singing or dancing or painting or going to the theater, I mean, that doing a little bit of that each day or as much as you can will help regulate our nervous systems, help, you know, alleviate stress and anxiety. I mean, because it's the way we are wired as humans.
You guys examined the healing nature of art and how it rejuvenates the mental, the body, and communities. And I noticed that, like, out of the various mediums, like, I also don't want to, like, kind of pigeonhole this into, like, one thing out of your many, like, hours and kind of branches of research. But out of the various mediums, music seems to be the most prevalent as it engages the body, the voice, the mind, and it bridges a bunch of people and communities together. Can you guys talk about the significance of this medium?
Well, I'll speak a little bit about sound, and maybe Susan could speak a little bit about music. You know, I've studied sound from, you know, way back, in fact, when monks were chanting, it was to give their organs a sonic massage, because, you know, we're all vibratory beings. And so when you put these vibrations back into your body, it's putting the original blueprint back in. In the book, I talk about carrying a pair of tuning forks with me. And when I was head of design at Mattel Toys, and one of the researchers was getting very nervous about the results that she was seeing, I pulled out the tuning forks, hit them on a hockey puck, vibrated them, and held them to her ears. And immediately she just relaxed and chilled. And it was the note of C and D, I think. But so we are, you know, sound is, we respond to it because they're now finding out in some early research that it could potentially be releasing some nitric oxide, right, Susan, that is the relaxation that causes relaxation. But it starts with sound, and then, you know, music, there's a lot about that in the book because it's one of the most researched art disciplines.
And nitric oxide, it actually puts more oxygen into the blood, which makes sense. It makes the blood healthier. And, you know, if you think about it this way, that the arts simultaneously alter a complex physiological network of interconnected systems, like your respiratory system, your circulatory system, your immune system, and even your muscular system. You know, there's nothing like that in any other kind of modality. And so when we think about, you know, music or other art forms, we think of them as really powerful neuromodulators. But as Ivy said, music is the most studied art form. And it makes sense because music is probably one of the first things that we really started to discover, because we're born in music, right? We're born in sound, in heartbeat. We're born in amplification, and we're over 60% water. So sound moves at a very rapid speed. In 3 milliseconds, sound reaches the internal body and brain. And so we're immediately affected, and music goes to our limbic systems, which are our ancient, you know, primal parts of our brain, where the parasympathetic nervous system is, where the amygdala is, that part of the brain that lets you know that something is happening and alerts you to information. Sometimes it's fear, but sometimes it's elation. And it also goes to the hippocampus and the auditory cortex. And the hippocampus is the part of the brain that processes information to create memory, right? To create long-term memory. So we remember songs from the time we were 3, 4 years old, and we can recall them when we're 83 and 84 years old, because our brains lay them down in the hippocampus, but then they also distribute into these repetitious patterns. So the brain is a duplicator. You know, these songs end up in the auditory cortex, they end up in the thalamus, they end up in the prefrontal cortex. And so if amyloid or plaque is hitting your hippocampus, which is one of the first areas of the brain that gets affected by Alzheimer's, other parts of the brain come online. And so our brain has this amazing ability to kind of hack itself and pull content out, and music and singing turn out to be the most powerful held art experiences. And so so we talk a lot about different ways that the arts, that kind of art, can be used. So from dancing and music to Parkinson's, to singing and Alzheimer's, to using music for disassociative symptoms with schizophrenia, or even for soothing the nervous system for stress and anxiety. I mean, it's pretty extraordinary. Fred Johnson in the book is in our flourishing chapter, and he talks about how he was put into an orphanage when he was very young, and he would sway and hum and find a way to soothe himself because nobody picked him up, nobody held him. And so he learned to use his body as an instrument to sway, like a mom would sway him. He learned how to sway himself and hum and sing. And ultimately, he's a very famous jazz musician, and also an African Jolly, which is a person that sings other people's stories. So music's powerful.
Can you guys expand on the importance of the accessibility of art?
Well, we do say that the arts are accessible, immediate, and affordable. If you are in a healthcare setting and you have an amazing discovery, it takes 10 to 15 years for that discovery to become something that the general public can have access to. And you may or may not be able to afford it. The arts are immediate. And so you can access things from singing in the shower to singing in the car and the radio to doodling. Doodling, you know, we now know focuses attention and also memory and recall more than people that don't doodle. We know that all of these dancing helps to release cortisol. Also, obviously, is really good for your muscular system. We know that the ability to be able to use these different art forms, and especially, it's really important to say, even if you're not proficient or have a gift or gifted at them, have significant impact. So, I mean, as Ivy said, we wrote the book because we felt that the research was there, and that while we wanted to build a field, we didn't want people to wait. And so, you know, there's an immediate ability to sing in a choir, or to sing with your family, or to make a meal that brings that, you know, culinary arts are an art, right? Or thinking about the way you read and think about books as bibliotherapy, how do you use those in a different way? So our idea is to change the lens on how you view the arts and aesthetics. And when you do change that lens, it's like a whole world opens up to you.
Is there anything else you two would like to add?
Make more art.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, as we say, art is the one universal language. We would love to see everyone just understand that it's our birthright, and no judgment. Just start indulging or making art.
Perfect. Thank you for speaking with me.
UCSB student reporter Brandon Yee with the authors of the book Your Brain on Art, Susan McSammon and Ivy Ross. And finally, putting into use the idea that music is healing and therapeutic, violinist Bryn Albanese brings live music to hospital patients across the Central Coast. It marks a new beginning for her as a certified music practitioner. A music practitioner is trained scientifically to use the intrinsic elements of live music as a type of therapy for different patient conditions. Here's KCBX's Beth Thornton.
I met Bryn Albanese outside at a local hospital in San Luis Obispo, where she had just played her violin for patients in the ICU. We sat in the garden, relaxing near a meditative fountain.
Definitely a new chapter in my life as a musician.
As a concert violinist, Albanese has performed on big stages around the world. She's toured with the Boston Symphony Orchestra and the Boston Pops. And San Luis Obispo locals know her from Café Musique. These days, she often plays for a single patient at a time in hospital rooms and memory care facilities on the Central Coast.
Being a person who performed music as a performance, to many, many, many people, solo or with orchestras or chamber music, coming full circle around to music as a service.
As one of the only certified music practitioners in the region, Albanese went through an intensive training program that brings together art and science. She studied the healing effects of music and how it's not just good for the soul, it's good medicine too.
A music practitioner is prescriptive with music in the moment. I am trained scientifically to use the intrinsic elements of live music as a type of therapy for different patient conditions.
Albanese says upon arriving at a hospital, she reports to the nurse's station and is directed to patients who might benefit from her services. For example, someone recovering from heart surgery.
That would be a certain type of music that I would play for them. And usually I would choose a music that I've learned called vital signs stabilization music.
There's also music specifically for patients with high anxiety and pain.
That kind of music is called relaxation response. So you're basically, it's my job in that moment to try to lower the patient's blood pressure, possibly. That would be one of my goals in that moment, and to get them to breathe.
Albanese says her specialty is working with dementia and Alzheimer's patients. She plays memory music, mostly familiar songs from the past that her patients might recognize.
Perhaps like Moon River or Simple Gifts, Over the Rainbow. Somehow, those simple tunes refocus the patient, and once in a while, you get someone singing.
Albanese also carries her Native American flute with her. She says the lower vibration of the wooden instrument is better suited to patients who are in palliative or comfort care.
The slower the vibrations, the more the body can actually relax.
She calls her work Pneuma Melodies. That's Pneuma with a P.
It is your breath, and it's your life force. It's what keeps you alive.
Albanese knows from her own personal experiences that music promotes healing of body, mind, and spirit. And she says the practice is gaining acceptance in medical settings.
Certified music practitioners were at one point more common on the East Coast than they are on the West Coast. Now we're starting to see more in some of the bigger cities.
Her hope is that the field will continue to grow and that more musicians will get trained to provide this type of therapeutic service to patients right here on the Central Coast. For KCBX, I'm Beth Thornton.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments. KCBX.org.